Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's show. The title of today's show is Violence, Humanitarian Efforts, and International Tools. I am Jeff Lambert, a senior at Central Michigan University, and I'm joined today by Erica Maley.
Hello.
And Hope May.
Hello.
So to get everybody on board, the show goal today is to imagine circumstances in which violence would be justifiable for humanitarian reasons and to discuss other means of enforcing humanitarian standards. It's a two-part show, and the first part is on violence as a means to pursue human rights, and really tied up in this question is that of responsibility. This is a continuation of sorts of last week's show. So to get everybody on board, I'm going to shoot it over to Erica, and she's going to address a question that she asked at the end of last week's show.
All right. So during last week's show, we were talking about how violence isn't always appropriate, or it often seems seldom appropriate to use when there's an international conflict or conflict of any sort. But then we began talking about how in Hannah Arendt's article called On Violence, she has this idea of what's called immense negative unity, in which basically the majority of people or a group of individuals refuse to do something or use what power they have as a collective majority to overpower those who are being disruptive and who are the minority. And what this made me think about was how at the international level, this immense negative unity appears to be present. At say, the national level, we talked about with our guest from last week how there are these institutions that people recognize as valid, and say, like the police or something, and people are willing to work with them and do what they can to bring the accused to justice. But at the international level, there aren't really such institutions. And also, when you're dealing with different countries with conflict with each other, sometimes other countries don't want to step in. And so at that point, it becomes immense negative unity, I feel like, because they're refusing to do something for these disruptors. But what about those that are being victims in these situations? Like, it may not be okay to do nothing because others are being harmed, but yet you don't want to interfere in a situation that doesn't involve you. So this is something that I kind of talked about and wanted to know a little bit more about. And so basically it's just this idea of a silent majority. What do you guys think about it? Any thoughts?
Coming from our experience over in the Netherlands, this really makes me think of sovereignty and the idea that these states, perhaps one of the reasons that they don't, that they aren't very willing to jump in the way of other people's transgressions, that it might just be this idea that, you know, what you do on your turf is fine as long as you don't infringe on what I do on my turf. So I think that there's this kind of rhetoric going on, although I feel as, I mean, obviously there's a contrast of institutions at the international level as compared to the domestic, but there is, I mean, with the ICC and some of these tribunals, it seems that maybe there is an influx of international institutions, so I'm not sure exactly how that's going to play out, but at least at a very base and simple level, it seems like part of the reason that countries are willing or unwilling to interfere is because of that idea of sovereignty, although we've discussed that there might be an out of that. But
and I want to say, you know, one thing that's happened in the 20th century to challenge this old idea of sovereignty is taking seriously, quote, human rights. And you know, you see this happening with the Nuremberg trials, done by the International Military Tribunal, I think, where a charge of crimes against humanity was levied against Germany, and not just Germany, but other parties who helped Germany, like business persons and industrialists. And in any case, to basically create it's almost like the institutions are following, are coming after this idea of human rights. And I think that there was this sense after World War II, maybe it was there before, but people just seem to be pretty fed up with the amount of atrocity that could be done in the name of a state and under the guise of sovereignty, that the world community, i.e. the United States, said we're not going to take it anymore. And those ideas of human rights and crimes against humanity having legal purchase, that they have, that has grown, and so we do have these international tribunals and the International Criminal Court. And I just want to say that it's a tricky mix to have this old idea of sovereignty on the one hand and also human rights on the other. And I think part of the challenge and why we don't see these international institutions is because it's taken a pretty long time to build these international legal institutions that recognize human rights. And it's also hard for people to give up their sovereignty. We see this with the whole scheme of the Rome Statute, where you choose to sign it. I'm not going to get into the complexities involving jurisdiction, but there's still a lot of power that individual countries have over their own affairs, even when we have the rule of law and human rights through complementarity and so forth. So, yeah, my point being that sovereignty and human rights, one has to yield to the other. And if one yields in a meaningful way, it's going to have to be through a sort of rule of law procedure and a legal institution.
Absolutely. And I think this idea that a violent minority, as Hannah Arendt pointed out, if the majority does nothing to stop it, they become an ally of that minority, and it just kind of it's like a snowball effect. And at one point in her article, again, it's called On Violence, she throws out some hypotheticals about what would happen if people stood up to violent minorities, and she doesn't really flesh it out, so I think we can do that now. You know, especially with Hitler and the Nazi regime, that's the easiest case in point. Their aggression really went unchecked, and obviously that violent minority, the Nazi regime, was infringing hugely upon human rights. So that kind of brings us to the first question other than this topic. You know, if the majority of people know what's going on, and by what's going on I mean infringing human rights, if the majority knows and does nothing, are they still as responsible as those who are committing the crimes? So it goes back to this responsibility notion. So I want to put that to the group and to the listeners. And if you listeners have anything to say or a question you want to raise to us throughout this discussion, you can always call in. The number to do that is 646-727-3928. So just to restate the question, is a group of nations or even individual nations duly responsible for human rights violations if they know about them and do nothing? Anybody want to take the lead here?
I'll just say, I'll start out by saying that I don't know that there is an answer that can be given for every situation in which this is the case. And it's a sticky situation for whatever country is faced with this. And I feel like the United States, it considers this at least more now than before. You know, when it seems like traditionally we've been intervening quite a bit, but a lot of times we say it's for human rights, and it might be some of those times, but other times, you know, we don't know if we don't want to become involved. But I feel like just in general for nations, I think it is a wrong to not intervene when you know something terrible is happening. I feel like it calls on individuals just on like a human instinctual level to want to help people that are in need. But I just don't know if intervening with violence is the right way to do it. And so I don't feel like there's a set answer for this, but I do feel that most nations feel like they they feel compelled to be involved. They just don't know how to go about doing it. And I don't think that they want to feel responsible for it, though. I think they want to be responsible for finding a solution. But I think that if any nation was accused at this point of contributing to these problems by not doing it, I feel like they would, I think that that would be offensive to them, because it really is a tough call and you don't know what to do.
Yeah, and I would say that, to restate the question again, it's, is a group of nations or even individual nations duly responsible for human rights violations if they knowingly do nothing to stop them? And I totally agree with Erica that there's this, like, this instinct, if you hear that something horrible is going on, that you feel at the very least moral outrage, and if you have the opportunity to help, you will. In addition, when we ask about responsibility, you know, I would make a distinction between moral responsibility on the one hand and legal responsibility on the other. And in fact, this question about degrees of responsibility in the law, you know, it's not clear cut. And in fact, in the law, you have different philosophies about legal responsibility. You do have a school of thought that says, oh, if you know that something is happening bad and you know that you're contributing to it, but you don't have the same evil intent. Like, for example, in Nazi Germany, you had the people producing the chemicals that were used in the gas chambers. These were the industrialists. They were chemists. It was a chemical company brought on trial. And in their defense, they said, well, we didn't plan to exterminate people with this chemical. And to which some people said, it doesn't matter if you planned it. You knew it was going to be used for that, and therefore you are legally responsible. And there are some people, on the other hand, who say, no, even if you know, that's not sufficient for legal liability. You actually have to have, like, the criminal purpose, and this is a big debate within theories of legal responsibility. So I would say perhaps when we ask this question, we might want to have, you know, sort of shades of responsibility where we talk about moral responsibility. Do we want a regime? Because it's all about enforcement. If we're going to take human rights seriously, what does it look like? Is it, okay, if we're morally responsible, what do we do? What does that mean? Legally responsible, what does that mean? And so, yeah, I just want to say, you know, knowingly, if they knowingly do nothing to stop them, it's all another complexity. So doing nothing, letting something happen. So I would just throw in, you know, you may want to make a distinction between moral and legal responsibility, and then within legal, you may want to have different categories of people who purposely did something versus people who didn't, and maybe, you know, the least offensive, but it's still a legal wrong, is for someone to do nothing, if that makes sense. So it's almost like, you know, murder one, murder two, murder three, so human rights violation one, human rights, that kind of scheme.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's a need to take each case as its own thing and not lump it into some category, because then you run into a whole world of problems. And like you guys have been saying, like, there's no clear-cut answer to any of this. You have to take, the resources available, first of all, of these states that know. It could just be a small country who's going through their own problems, and they simply don't have the resources. So then what is their level of responsibility? Do they have to, like, make a phone call to some big nation who has the resources? And then, so, yeah, I just think that it's no clear-cut answer. And I think now's a good time to, since we're on this notion of sense of responsibility, I want to throw in Rwanda. And it seems like in the wake of Rwanda, since nations knew that something was going on, in the wake of that, there seems to be, like, this obligation of world governments to assist in cases of known violations of human rights. But at the same time, there are endless cases in which military action has furthered violence and enabled further human rights violations. So then this question that we've kind of been getting at is, well, how do we fulfill this obligation? Because obviously, as we pointed out, there is some sort of obligation, there is some sort of notion that, hey, if we know this is going on, we feel the need to do something. But what does that something look like? Is it a military intervention? Is it a diplomatic intervention? What is it? So maybe we can discuss this question a little bit further. Do you guys want to say anything?
Sure. Okay, so can you just give a summary of the question one more time, just
yeah.
so like it's more directed or?
Yeah,
sure.
In light of the obligation that we feel to do something about human rights violations, how do we fulfill this obligation?
Okay, so by not taking like action
yeah,
via violence
some,
or something?
Well, it could be violence.
Okay.
Some sort of reaction, I mean, given that we feel the need to react, what does this reaction take
what
the form
the
of? What
be?
Could it be?
Okay. Well, I feel like what a lot of countries have been trying to do and it's like raise awareness for the situation because when people don't know about what's going on, it's a lot easier for these individuals that are committing these wrongs to get away with them. So I feel like countries that don't take action, I guess, by physically doing something, a lot of the times what they try to do is make it aware what's actually happening. And then I feel like that results in action from some individuals then that have the resources or feel compelled. And I feel like what happens a lot then is other countries, speak up and say something to the country where this conflict is occurring and, you know, express that they're not okay with this, this is wrong. And this kind of gets into, like, sanctions. And I feel like countries, you know, at this point maybe threaten to do something to that country if the violence doesn't end, but I don't know. I mean, I guess if they're not taking like violence, I guess what they just try to do is like make sure people know what's going on and hope that that's enough to scare people into not doing it.
That's interesting because I had in my notes military or diplomatic action. I never thought about kind of leaving it up to individuals. Almost it sounds like so.
Well,
if you raise awareness, do you mean like the people of your country could step up, like the people who have resources, or are you saying raising awareness on an international
I think on the international
state level where other states become aware of it and then they...
Yeah, I think that that's like more at what I would get at by saying that like just the more nations that like begin to put pressure on this country and make it not okay, and because I feel like nowadays like countries are primarily so dependent on other nations to just on an economic basis for political reasons. And so I just feel like once they start to feel a certain amount of pressure, I feel like that's enough to deter some of the violence from happening. But then again, you also, I guess I have to consider that a lot of the violence that occurs isn't from the governments per se, it's rebels within that country where this violence, because it is the minority and the majority hasn't done something yet, so I don't know. Hope, do you have anything?
Wow. Well, I guess, so going back to the question is, if you're aware of horrible atrocities going on, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Quay Nation?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm going to say I'm going to start by saying that question, if we frame it, Quay Nation, we're already dealing in abstractions because nation is an abstraction. State is an abstraction. Remember this from Judgment at Nuremberg at the very end. This is a movie, Judgment at Nuremberg, if you haven't seen it, see it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But at the very end of the film, Ernst Janning, who's a very revered and respected judge, writer of many books on justice, but he was a tool of the Third Reich. And in this film, he's put on trial because he basically rubber-stamped the orders of the Third Reich, was not following the rule of law whatsoever. And this is a part of the movie where he's talking about the Feldenstein case, and he says, before the case even happened, I had my mind already made up. There was no looking at evidence. There was no, he was going to find this guy guilty. So rule of law totally thrown out the window. And he ends up saying the reason why he did this was because for love of country and love of state, which is an abstraction. And I think for me to make to wrap my mind around this question about if I'm aware of like horrible atrocities going on, what does one do? So there's the question, what does one do qua state? Then there's the question, what does one do as an individual? And to this I want to turn to the work of our good friend, Leo Tolstoy. His picture is like the mascot of Ethics Talk. And this is from, this is not on the show resources page, but I will put it up there, and it's easily available on the internet, and it's one of his essays called Bethink Yourselves. And he says this, if you face, and I'm throwing in our question into his writing, but I think he would say this. So if you see yourself in the midst of violence and your buddies are calling you to, like, join the fight, because Tolstoy is a pacifist, you do this. You say, you interrupt your work and you ask yourself, who am I? I love it. From whence have I appeared? And in what consists my destiny? And having answered these questions, according to the answer, decide whether that which thou doest is in conformity with thy destiny. And he continues, before I am emperor, soldier, minister, or journalist, so all of these social categories, you know, secretary of state, commander in whatever, before I am these roles, every person must say to himself, before any of these things, I am a man, and this is just a great part, i.e., an organic being sent by the higher will into a universe infinite in time and space in order, after staying in it for an instant, to die, i.e. to disappear from it. So I'm an organic being. I'm sent into infinite time and space for a blip to die. And what is my destiny? And I just love this. And Tolstoy in this piece says, this is the problem, that nobody asks themselves this question and they get caught up in these categories like for the state, for the country. And this is how war is able to perpetuate itself. Why people removing themselves from this very personal question and thinking in these necessarily abstract terms. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking of Judgment at Nuremberg, and you know, the same point is made. And I think it's a very powerful point. So I would say, should you find yourself in such a situation where in the face of atrocious violence, you start by asking yourself this question, who am I? And then see if responding to that violence in whatever way is being called upon you resonates with your answer to these fundamental questions, if that makes sense. It might be an opportune time for the playing of this clip from the Einstein documentary, Einstein, The World, I think it's called The World and How I See It, because Einstein was, for most of his life, a pacifist, until he learned that his former state, and he actually disassociated himself from Germany, so he couldn't go to war. He became stateless. When he learned that Germany was making or trying to make nuclear weapons, he changed his mind. He reneged on his pacifism, and he embraced what's referred to in this clip as a, quote, militant pacifism, which is, it's okay to use violence, you know, to stop the evil. So this is like a 5-minute clip, and you can watch the whole segment from which it comes on our show resources page, ethicstalk.cmich.edu, and here is the clip. It may be a little bit hard to hear, so just be forewarned, it's about 5 minutes long.
When the Nazis came into power, Einstein, I think, was faced with a dilemma. Should he continue with his pacifism, or should he do what he could to resist the Nazis in their effort to get control of the whole world?
He said that he would be willing to subscribe to the idea to resist force with force. Because he said otherwise it's like trying to cure a sick tribe of people. You try to cure them in a way that is too slow, that by the time you cure them by pacifist way, they're all dead. That's not very efficient.
who are such a badly messed up people. It will be very difficult to remedy the situation by sensible, not to speak of humane, means. I keep hoping that at the end of the war, with God's benevolent help, they will largely kill each other off. Many absolute pacifists felt betrayed by Einstein's militant pacifism. But Hitler forced his hand. In 1939, news came to Einstein that German physicists had succeeded in producing nuclear fission. The uranium atom could now be split. Germany might be able to develop a bomb.
We were very worried that the Germans will develop atomic weapons. We wanted, therefore, to interest the United States to develop nuclear weapons so that Hitler should not be the only one to possess them. And it was a friend of mine, Dr. Szilard, who had the idea that Einstein should write a letter to Roosevelt, and maybe that will have some effect. He did not know about the fission process, which was, of course, the basis of the difficulty. But he understood it in 15 minutes, and he dictated a letter. It was taken to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt appointed the Bureau of Standards to look into the question of nuclear weapons and see whether they are possible and what effect they may have.
Sir, some recent work by E. Fermi and L. Szilard leads me to expect that the element uranium may be turned into a new and important source of energy in the immediate future. It is conceivable that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. In view of this situation, you might think it desirable to put forward a recommendation for government action. The government gathered the top American and European exile scientists to work on the Manhattan Project, headed by Robert Oppenheimer. Science and government were at the beginning of a new and ambitious partnership. Einstein was not called to participate. He remained in Princeton. The work at Los Alamos was considered too confidential to be entrusted to Einstein. He was considered a security risk.
But we did not want it to be exploded over a Japanese city, but over open territory, to show it to the Japanese scientists that there is something terrible and Japan should come to a good peace with the United States. Well, we tried to persuade the people, the government, but we did not succeed.
On March 25, 1945, Einstein sent a second letter to President Roosevelt, warning of the catastrophic consequences that would result if the atom bomb were ever actually used. FDR died a few days later. The letter lay unopened on his desk.
Right, so that was the clip, Einstein and How I See the World, or something like that. It's from a documentary. Link to it on our show resources page. So going back to this Tolstoy clip, here you have Einstein learning about the scientific progress towards nuclear weapon, and perhaps he felt it his task in life and his destiny to inform the government, which he did, but I think it's interesting, and perhaps this is a segue into part two, because the scientists, they say it was never their intention to actually use the bomb and drop it on human beings, but almost as a way of deterring the Japanese from continuing the war, like, okay, look what we can do, therefore stop. And in fact, that wasn't done. So it's almost as if the scientists were wanting to use this weapon, not really, but as just posturing. Sadly, that didn't happen. So over to you, Jeff.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's really interesting to connect the two. I mean, obviously Einstein asked himself, who am I and what do I do in response to this knowledge that I have? So that's super cool. I guess we can jump into the second part of the show, which is tools and government's so-called tool belt. And by that we mean the options open to a state to enforce humanitarian standards given their knowledge of human rights infringements. So we know that our group specifically, all being members of the International Criminal Court Student Network and studying the ICC this past summer, that's something that's very much present in our lives. So we know that the ICC itself is a newly formed international institution that seeks to hold individuals responsible for violations of human rights. But since we've been talking about, well, how do we fulfill the obligation of doing something, what would it look like? I guess now would be a great time to discuss some of the other tools that we do have out there at the international level. So I'm going to switch it to Erica because she is hugely interested in the UN and hopes to pursue a career there someday. I thought she could discuss some of the options that we have at the United Nations level. Erica?
All right. And as Jeff said, I am interested in the UN, but I by no means claim to be an expert. yeah, I guess I did a little reading tonight before the show, and something that pulled me in and I was reading about was the United Nations and what it says in Chapter 7 of its Charter on action with respect to threats to the peace, breaches of the peace, and acts of aggression. And a lot of it was about when the Security Council of the UN can decide to, like, use armed force. Like when it's justified for countries. And honestly, I started thinking about, I mean, when does the Security Council really know best? And I mean, I guess we're looking at them as an authority on it, but do they really know better than anybody else? And I mean, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. That's something to think about. And apparently they can take action by land, air, or sea, these forces. And I mean, that sounds like it could be violent to me. So, I mean, other tools that governments use, though, I mentioned briefly earlier, are like sanctions and such. And I feel like cutting off diplomatic ties with another nation and just, I mean, that's extreme, but it has happened. And I feel like the UN is the place where this occurs when countries just don't want to be part of something another country is doing. I don't know, does anybody else have any comments on this? I mean, I don't claim to be an expert on this at all, but I'm just interested in it and learning about it too.
Well, just to follow up on that with some more Tolstoy, if I may, you know, this question, does the UN Security Council, do they know any better? And Tolstoy would say, no, they don't. And here, and this is written in the early 1900s. And here's Tolstoy. And this is after the Hague Peace Conferences and the Peace Palace and the International Committee of the Red Cross. And so there was a big movement. And it's so funny because in this piece, Tolstoy is witnessing all of this rhetoric about peace and harmony amongst nations. But in fact, the actions of states are really belying that rhetoric. And so the question is, what is going to bring peace and security, right? Is it these strategic air battle, whatever? And Tolstoy is going to say no. He says, the deliverance of man, not only from the calamities of war, but also from all of the calamities which men inflict upon themselves, will take place not through emperors or kings instituting peace alliances, nor those who would dethrone emperors, kings, or who strain them by constitutions, or substitute republics for monarchies, not by peace conferences, not by the realization of socialistic programs, not by victories or defeats on land or sea, not by libraries or universities, nor those futile mental exercises which are now called science. So, like, all the things that we think, right, and all the things that were going on at his time, peace conferences, summits, whatever, okay, no. The only way that we're going to resolve this, again, it's going to sound out there, right, because, of course, that's the way we think. Of course, you go to the UN Security Council. Of course, we see what the UN has to say. Tulsa's going to say, no, this has all been done before. It's all old. Only when such people realize the kingdom of God in themselves, in their souls, will establish without directly aiming at this purpose the external kingdom which every human soul is longing for. So his claim is that only if, like, individuals do this personal work, it's not through institutions. It cannot be. It's only if each person asks themselves these questions that I was mentioning before, and it's this internal work that something external will display itself, which other people will recognize as true and real and good. Anyway, so that's my two cents. Tolstoy.
Yeah, that's... It seems... I wonder if part of the process of getting individuals to think that way could be through institutions, though, just to get the ball rolling.
Okay.
I'm just wondering.
Nice.
That's just what I thought of.
Love it. Build it.
It seems so straightforward, like, what you're saying and everything, like, when you hear it, but I feel like it's just, like, ingrained in, like, our mentality, like, how we think about governments, to think of, like our governments as, like, something that represents us, and I feel like that's why governments maybe don't think about it as, like a human individual, like, who am I type of level. They're thinking, well, what about, like, my country, or what about the people that I'm representing or something, and sometimes that can maybe, like, cloud judgment and take away from, like, the human aspect of it, which is basically what this all comes down to. These are human beings that are suffering.
Yeah, and this is nothing new. I mean, if you go back to Socrates, I mean, here you have, you know, a government, and you had Socrates trying to do it as a private person, getting people to think and do this kind of thing that Tolstoy is talking about, and people didn't take too kindly to it. And in very interesting passages, he says, I'm practicing the true political craft by being a private citizen and doing this stuff on the streets, if you will. But it's not old, and, you know, just to follow Tolstoy here and his great cynicism, perhaps, you know, this, it's true that there's this instinct to just think government, 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 protecting my interests. But on the other hand, there's a lot of wisdom, you know, ancient wisdom of the importance of the individual search and individual personality and so forth. And you don't hear that with as much fervor. I mean, that's not the same instinctive thing, and perhaps that's out of the interests of government, because if you have a lot of people, you know, thinking for themselves, then suddenly what's in power is no longer in power. I think that's what Socrates was doing, and I think that's why people were threatened by him. So I would say, you know, it's in people's interest to keep the majority of people in the dark and go, oh, okay, so the UN, they're going to, oh, okay, the International Criminal Court. And because it seems like it's hard, but it's really not. It's all within, it's not rocket science.
Right.
It's absolutely not rocket science. But it's not talked about, and so we feel sort of intimidated in the face of it. So I would say, yeah. And the thing with institutions, they require individuals to keep their true purpose alive, and that's always tricky business.
Absolutely. I think even if the question of, you know, who am I and what do I stand for, even if that question is asked, it seems to not transcend the government threshold. It seems like, well, as soon as government gets brought up, well, stop asking that question, because it's not no longer who am I, but, you know, we're representative of the people and we have a duty to protect our people. But I think that if world leaders were to ask this question, who I am, and it could even be, well, who am I as a nation's leader, like, what do I stand for, what would I do on a personal level? I think that this question of, or this notion of, we're all human and we're all basically trying to accomplish the same thing. So, you know, that right there might start to bleed into this national patriotism thing, where, you know, it's, well, I did it in the name of my nation and my state and my country. Well, oftentimes what happens in that formation of a national personality, you contrast yourself against other nations and say, well, they're about this and we're not about that. I mean, case in point, Afghanistan and Iraq versus America and the Western philosophy. You say, well, in part of coming up with your character, you point to an enemy and say, well, we're definitely not that. But at the same time, if you ask, well, really, who am I and what am I standing for, you could see that, okay, well, we're all trying to accomplish the same things. We're all human. So I think that's super cool insight, and maybe hopefully with this, I mean, even though we've said that institutions aren't really where it happens, but maybe if this push towards international institutions that uphold humanity, maybe leaders will start to think about that question a little more seriously as the trend of taking human rights seriously seems to continue.
Can I use this opportunity to play this like 1 minute clip?
Absolutely.
From the BBC on Libya, because anyway, I'm just going to play the clip and then I'll explain why I'm playing the clip after. It's only a minute. It's really quick, and it's from March when we first started to do the NATO mission against Libya. Here it is.
Difficult position now, where Colonel Gaddafi is dug in with his own people in Libya. Very hard to winkle him out from the air. No sign at the moment of any kind of putsch. He's got nowhere to run to. And therefore, this could be a very, very long process of stalemate, and possibly, as I say, the separation of what is now Libya into two different places.
Well, as I say, stalemate is preferable to slaughter.
Yeah.
I think the government has a heavy responsibility in the meetings it's got this week to be working on all possible scenarios to make sure, for example, that post-conflict planning is in place, thinking about humanitarian aims. But the other aspect that's much forgotten of Resolution 1973, which we supported, is that it sanctions non-military means of putting pressure on the regime. So whether that is further sanctions, whether that's what's called an escrow account, whereby you could cut off the oil revenues that have supported the Gaddafi regime for many years, we need to be working hard on the diplomatic, work on the diplomatic track to put pressure on the regime at the same time as on the military track to protect the population of Libya.
And what...
Right. So, yeah, that clip came into my mind when you were talking, because it's very easy, and we started to talk about this last week when we were talking about the Young piece on so-called humanitarian intervention, and it's very easy to take these abstract terms like humanity and post-conflict humanitarian, I forgot the last word of that, but there are these post-conflict humanitarian goals that we have in place. So afterwards, we do have these aims. And I worry that this word, because how could you be opposed to humanitarian anything? So automatically it has me at hello, like the word humanitarian. But, like, what is it? I mean, I'm attracted to it, but what does it really mean? And this goes back to the second question of how violence gets legitimated is by being couched in these, for the sake of these goals that, of course I'm like pro-humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just say, if there is, you know, some sort of whatever movement or institution or whatever, that we keep asking for the real flesh and blood meaning of this word, rather than just being sort of swayed by it uncritically, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Because I think that's where we are now. I don't know what it means. I know I like the word. Do you guys know what it means?
I mean, I know what it means for me, but that's probably entirely different for what it means to other people, and I think that's important too. But to comment off of what you said, it seems to me that there's this real danger of just shifting the rhetoric and putting humanitarian effort in front of violence to say, oh, well, that's just a great way to get the people on board, when really you're doing it for your own gains and your own personal reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this whole notion that we've been discussing of stopping to ask, like, well, who am I, what am I doing, what do I stand for, that can't stop to happen because it's like, are you saying humanitarian efforts for the reputation and to get other people on board with your personal aspirations, or are you doing it to be humanitarian for that sake in itself? So I think that question needs to be asked of any effort internationally, but especially that of violence. So,
And just to go back to Tolstoy, this idea of framing the question, I think you put it like respecting humanitarian standards. Is that language? So there are these humanitarian standards, and what does it look like to respect them in the face of atrocities? Mm-hmm. So whatever, there's some standards and there's atrocities and what have you. And this passage by Tolstoy that I read before, again, I'm going to just read the last sentence, only when you realize this internal thing in yourself, that the kingdom is in you. And P.S., I'm sure we've said it before, but perhaps you've never heard our shows before, so I'll say it again. Tolstoy wrote a very wonderful book called The Kingdom of God is Within You, which is the book that Gandhi read. And, of course, Martin Luther King was influenced by Gandhi. And in our country, the United States, when we hear about nonviolent peace movements, it's usually like Gandhi and MLK. But, in fact, it's coming from Tolstoy, who lived during the whole peace movement in Europe and saw the hypocrisy of it, and saw the hypocrisy of the Hague peace conferences, the Peace Palace, the libraries, everything he lists. But, anyway, he's alluding to this other work. The kingdom of God is in you, and without directly aiming at this purpose, without directly aiming at, you know, the enforcement of humanitarian standards, and paraphrasing. So it's sort of like you focus inward, and then this outward respect for humanitarian stuff will be a natural consequence. That's what he says. Socrates, or I should say Plato, says the same thing. Famous passage I've mentioned many times. Wealth does not bring virtue, but from virtue comes wealth and all other good things known to man. So it's this sort of internal activity which has practical benefits. And we're focused on the practical benefits first. Mm-hmm. And we think that produces the internal value, and it doesn't. It's first the internal, then the external. So I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it, because it's almost like there are these values, humanitarian standards, human rights, these abstract terms that exist outside of me, and I want to likey-likey them. And what Tolstoy is saying is, if you really want to likey-likey them, likey-likey yourself. And then you'll like them really, truly.
It's so cool to me how something that could help an individual's life, no matter where they are, could also transcend into this international level and help the world as a whole, given institutions and governments. Like, if they just ask the questions that every human being should ask themselves, we could get us all on this coming from the right stance, like the right foundation, and then from that foundation, I mean, to keep the metaphor going, like a beautiful home will be built upon it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many examples of the truth of that. One being Muhammad Yunus, who won, it may have been the Nobel Peace Prize. No, I think it was maybe the Nobel Prize in Economics. But he founded the Grameen Bank, there's this whole movement called microfinance, so giving really, really small loans, like really minuscule loans. And it started out just giving it to women because the men would take the money and drink and waste it all. But the way that Muhammad Yunus, you know, quote, came up with the idea, he wasn't trying to eradicate, he wasn't trying to, you know, support any sort of, quote, humanitarian goal. He was basically on his way to work at university, and he was sort of tripping over people who were just in the street. You know, they were just like in his way, on his way to work. And it was just, he realized, well, I have a very simple thing to get these people like out of the street so I can get into I wasn't just totally selfish. He didn't want to just like clear a thoroughfare to his office. But this is how the problem presented itself to him, like in the context of his life, was people in my way when I'm going to office, me helpy them. And then it resulted in this whole movement that now private banks are into. So it's this very small thing that you do personally, which if done with the right motives and intentions, does flower out. And as you say, builds a nice home. I would say garden or kingdom.
Yeah. I think with a few minutes left here in the show, instead of really going through the individual tools, I kind of want to shift to this last question. And basically, it's continuing what we've been talking about. In situations where violent reinforcement is lacking, and personally I'm thinking of the arrest warrants of the ICC, given that there is no enforcement, there's no police to enforce these warrants, unlike at a domestic level, is the effectiveness of these institutions hindered? Case in point, in Libya, Gaddafi failed to comply with the ICC arrest warrant, and now this armed conflict has ensued. So the last question I want to raise to you guys is, do cases like this prove that violence is needed? And if so, I mean, it could be qualified violence, and I think that's the personal stance I'm going to take, but are these institutions still effective enough to do what we like to enforce these humanitarian standards that I've been discussing, or do we like never need to rely on violence? So, I mean, to put it succinctly, is violence needed? Is it necessary? Or can we get by through these institutions without it? Hope or Erica, do you want to take the lead?
Me now. Okay. Hello. To answer this, this is like really tough. I think this is another question where there isn't a yes or a no answer. So to try to answer it, I mean, I think the ICC is doing what it can at this point. I mean, honestly, this is such a huge case and like such a huge issue. I mean, I realize it was issued months ago, but still at the same time thinking about like the how serious the situation is. I mean, yeah, you want it to him to be caught as quickly as possible, but this is such a huge, he's in a country and like maybe they've narrowed down where he is, but like, I mean, this is a hard task that they have to face. And like, I mean, I guess, you know, it would be easier if there was a police force or something of that nature to enforce it and go get him. But I think it says a lot more if we're able to catch him without it, and if the people comply and are the ones that want him gone. And I think that they're going about it the right way.
So I do know, I don't know where it went, but I think at one point the prosecutor was asking Interpol. There is like an international police force, Interpol, and I think the ICC was asking Interpol to execute this warrant. I don't know where that is right now, but my question is just on the question itself. Are you presuming that the enforcing of an arrest warrant or the execution of it, so warrant, execution, guy captured. Mm-hmm. I mean, Gaddafi, I mean, I guess he would, one might turn themselves over, but
right.
This guy is not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So are you presuming that, like, the activity involved in executing the arrest warrant is violent?
I guess I'm asking, does it need to be violent?
So the Interpol has to corner Gaddafi and threaten him? Or
It could be that way. I'm asking, like, would the violence be more effective than, let's say, just putting pressure on them? And, I mean, I don't know if that pressure would come in form of economic sanctions or what that would be.
I mean, the pressure is pretty...
I mean, yeah.
We're putting the pressure on.
But through violence. So I'm wondering if... I mean, is that the most effective means to...
Yeah, I mean, I think with someone like Gaddafi, who's clearly all about power and
right.
will maintain it no matter what the cost,
mm-hmm.
yeah. But I also want to say, like, with the ICC, the effectiveness of it is not just determinant on whether or not violence assists it
right.
because of what's happening in Africa with Sudan and the president traveling freely and states which live through people are not complying with their duties to arrest him.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not buying into what the court stands for. And so of course that's necessary for it to be effective. You have to have
right.
this buy-in, which is not, it's like this consent. We were talking about this last week, power. So, to point out also, if you don't know, when the, quote, alleged bad guy comes to the court, he can either do so through an arrest warrant or through a summons to appear. Mm-hmm. And in this case, and the summons to appear, you appear voluntarily, and that has happened.
Yeah.
They didn't ask for Gaddafi to appear, perhaps because they knew it would be futile. They could have. So, what do you think, Jeff?
I don't know. Originally when framing this question, I didn't really think about it, but I'm reminded of Joseph Nye and our discussions about him in the class that we took studying the ICC, and how he argued that soft power as opposed to hard power would be violence and coercion versus soft power, which is the opposite of that, and how now soft power seems to be more effective. So, I mean, right off the bat, I want to say, well, no, violence isn't needed, especially if we have institutions that can put enough legitimate pressure to force compliance. But at the same time, it's not that cut and dry. And like we just said, the legitimacy of the pressure requires that the people feeling the pressure actually buy into it and feel like, well, yeah, if we don't do this, something will actually happen. It's almost like I'm reminded of, you know, if a parent says, well, if you don't do this, you're going to be grounded, and you know that you're not going to get grounded, you're still going to do it. Yeah, you might get yelled at, but, you know, when it comes onto it, you'll still be able to leave the house. So it's like, I mean, I want to say that violence is never needed, but if it's just continuing and you've done everything that you can try to do, you put diplomatic pressure, say, well, we won't let you participate in this conference or these talks, or let your say be heard, and they're like, well, okay, we don't care. And then you're like, well, we're going to put economic sanctions on you, which we were talking before the show might actually hurt the people in the state more than going in and removing them from power. So I don't know. I mean, I framed the question, and it's hard for me to even come up with a clear answer. I think it's hard for everybody, but I think it's almost like in my mind I'm seeing like a two-step process. Step one, you go in with the soft power tactic of saying, okay, we know that this is going on, and we're planning on taking steps. I mean, I think involved in that is the ICC investigations, and then if that leads into a full-out arrest warrant or summons to appear, that's all part of the process. And I think the UN and the other tools that we were going to discuss, like civil society, I think that all goes into it. But at a certain point, I feel like you have to draw that line that says, you know what, we just won't stand for it anymore. So I think, I mean, I'm not – the problem is when do you draw that line? And do you let them step over the line a little bit, or do you just take the hard stance, okay, you put one toe across it and we're going after you with everything we got? So I think that what I said at the onset is this qualified violence. And, you know, what goes into that is obviously consideration of the consequences. And by that, I mean that you don't want to go into a situation and just completely mess everything up where you just go and bomb everything and then there's just destruction and you're like, okay, well, we got you out and now we're gone. We did our part. So you got to take that. But then again, if you ask a question, like we've been saying, who am I? What do I stand for? And obviously this person or this, like, I think at a certain point you have to stand up for it and rely on violence because, I mean, even as Arendt said, violence can be justified. And I think that, you know, if we didn't go in there and physically take Hitler and the Nazis out of power, they would have continued to do it as long as they could. So, yeah, I think at a certain point you do, but I think it's definitely part the second step in the two-step process. Does anybody, Hope or Erica, do you want to elaborate?
I think it was well said. I think you made some good points and on issues that are really hard to sort out.
Well, thanks.
So there's just like 18 seconds left, so
all right,
well,
thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks everybody for listening, and don't forget, if you want to see any of the articles or hear any of the clips, you can always check out our show resources page, which again, our website is ethicstalk.cmich, UCLA.edu. And thanks for listening, and we'll plan on having another show next Tuesday at 7.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.